This week, the families of 43 missing Mexican students began touring the United States. They're hoping to find supporters who will pressure the Mexican government into reopening the investigation into what happened. I'm Joey Palacios from Texas Public Radio, and I'm this week's guest host on Fronteras, a public radio collaboration that brings you stories about the U.S.-Mexico border region. A coalition of human rights activists is sponsoring the Mexican students who survived the police confrontation and the relatives of the 43 who are missing. Even though Mexican officials have said the students were murdered, relatives told audiences in San Antonio they believe the students may still be alive. Texas Public Radio's Shelley Koffler reports.
24-year-old Omar Garcia believes survival carries responsibility, which is why he tells and retells the story of what happened to him and his classmates last fall.
On the 26th of September, 90 of my friends and I went to Iguala.
At Our Lady of the Lake University in San Antonio, Garcia tells an audience of about 80 that he and other male students from a rural teacher's college in Ayotzinapa, about an hour from Acapulco, had decided to go to the nearby city of Iguala. They were going to raise money for a bigger trip to Mexico City, where they would participate in a commemoration of the 1968 deaths of student protesters who died following a police confrontation. To reach their destination, the students decided to hijack a bus.
And we do it because we don't have buses in our locality. You know, we just don't have transportation.
The bus driver alerted authorities. Then the students took off in the buses and the police pursued.
One police car stopped us, blocked our way. The police started shooting at random at the buses and shooting at our students.
Several students were wounded. 43 others were forced into police vehicles, and their families haven't seen them since.
The following day, we showed up at the police department, parents asking for the children, and we were asking for the compañeros, and they were not around.
Garcia is among the student survivors and parents who are now traveling to 50 U.S. cities, hoping to generate support for a more thorough investigation. In January, Mexico's attorney general said the government investigation concluded the local mayor had turned the students over to a drug gang because some of the students were suspected of being members of a rival gang. He said the 43 had been tortured, killed, and their bodies burned. Garcia and relatives of the students don't believe that because bodies haven't been found.
Do you think they're still alive?
Claro que creo que están vivos.
Yes, for sure. Of course, I do believe they're still alive.
Julio Cesar Guerrero of San Antonio helped organize the Caravan 43 tour, as it's called. He says he, like many of those involved on this side of the border, have friends and family in Mexico and want the Mexican government to be held accountable.
We cannot shame our government in Mexico anymore because they don't have no shame. They do feel shame when we say those things outside of Mexico. When you come to the States and say those things, they don't like that. And so that's a way of putting pressure on the Mexican government by saying things outside of Mexico.
Our Lady of the Lake student Jennifer Garza says she feels a connection with the suffering relatives. Her own family is of indigenous Mexican heritage, and she believes a chorus of U.S. voices could push the Mexican government into doing more.
What we can do is connect with the Mexican consul. We can spread the word. That is the best thing that we can do. The word of mouth travels and moves mountains.
At the Texas Capitol, with relatives of the 43 watching, state senators unanimously passed a resolution extending their condolences. Senator Jose Menendez from San Antonio addressed the visitors and lawmakers.
I can only think about the outrage that we would have in this country if 43 of our college students went missing from their school. I don't think any of us would stop until every stone was unturned, until we'd find what happened or where those students were.
Garcia and the Caravan 43 relatives plan to meet with other U.S. lawmakers, Amnesty International, and an International Human Rights Commission. They believe if they tell their stories often enough in the right places, the full story of the 43 missing students will eventually be known. Shelley Koffler, Texas Public Radio News.
As Caravan 43 tries to gather support for the students' families, a petition is circulating through Texas and the United States focused on some other families. Its goal is to end the detention of immigrant mothers and children who are entering the country unlawfully. As KUT's Joy Diaz reports, a recent wave of suicide attempts by women in detention in Texas has been a catalyst for the petition.
Berenice is not her real name. But her attorney has asked me to call her that to protect her identity because she's an asylum seeker. For the last 3 months, Berenice and her toddler have been detained in Dilley, Texas, the largest immigration detention center in the country.
El niño dice, mami, matémonos, mami. Mami, ya no quiero estar aquí.
There's a little boy there that begs his mom to kill him and kill herself. He says, let's kill ourselves. I can't stand this place any longer.
El niño le dice, a ella le dieron una fianza de $15,000.
Their despair is because her bond was set at $15,000.
Berenice had not considered killing herself. But then, her bond was set at $9,000. Her cousins in New York haven't even been able to scrape enough for her airplane ticket, much less $9,000.
Yo me quedé en shock.
I was shocked.
Que no tenía salida para mi problema.
I thought there was no way out.
Perdí mi cabeza.
I lost my head.
On Thursday, Berenice tried to kill herself too. She was rushed to the hospital. That night, she was released to her attorney. Her bond waived. Rachel Gore Freed is an attorney with the Unitarian Universalist Service Committee, a human rights organization. She started the petition that hopes to stop the incarceration of women like Berenice, and also the detention of immigrant children.
They're essentially refugees.
And according to the UN, refugees are not to be incarcerated, much less released on bond. On Mother's Day, Gore Freed will deliver the petition to the Obama administration. In Austin, I'm Joy Diaz.
Most suicides in the United States are committed with guns. That's according to the Centers for Disease Control. And in New Mexico, that statistic is even higher. There, suicides from guns also account for most of the firearms deaths. The country's Surgeon General says gun violence is a public health issue. In the last 10 years, there have been more than 300,000 civilian gun deaths in our country. That's similar to the number of military casualties in the nation's biggest wars. Fronteras reporter Marisa DeMarco of KUNM has more from Albuquerque on the connection with guns.
In rural parts of New Mexico, many people use guns as tools in their daily lives.
This is my 12-gauge shotgun, and I'd say it's definitely the most versatile tool in the gun cabinet. And you could take anything from the smallest game all the way up to the largest game in North America down.
Billy Ogle shows me his collection of firearms on his property in Belen, where he and his wife keep goats, cows, and chickens.
They make blanks, and it can just be a noisemaker, which is mainly what I use it for at night when I hear coyotes come to the animals. But I've never actually shot any animals. Just use it for scare tactics.
That's not the only reason Ogle maintains an assortment of handguns and rifles.
The real reason I own guns is I think they're fun. I like to shoot them. I like the sport. Main thing I do is shoot holes and paper targets.
Ogle says even people selling guns privately should be required to conduct background checks, though he's not sure how a rule like that could be enforced. But a lot of people think background checks violate the Second Amendment of the Constitution. They argue those checks don't thwart criminals, but instead hinder people who intend to legally buy guns to defend themselves, their family, and their property.
New Mexico is one of the states with the least amount of gun regulation.
Jeffrey Swanson is a professor of psychiatry at Duke University. He visited Albuquerque recently as part of the Consortium for Risk-Based Firearm Policy.
New Mexico is interesting. It's about average in terms of its household gun possession rate, according to surveys. Let's just assume that people are telling the truth to a surveyor when they ask, do you have guns at home?
Swanson says 34% or 35% of New Mexicans say they have guns at home. In other states, that number can be closer to 50%. New Mexico does not have some federal gun restrictions on the books, and that means those rules aren't enforced here, like prohibiting people from buying guns who've been committed short-term to a mental institution involuntarily, or people under temporary domestic violence restraining orders.
But New Mexico is very high in its firearm-related fatality rate. A lot of that has to do with an elevated suicide rate.
The state's suicide by firearm death rate is almost twice the national average, and according to the CDC, 68%, little more than two-thirds, of New Mexico's gun deaths are suicide. Garen Wintemute is an emergency doctor in Sacramento, California.
Most people who die from gunshot wounds die where they are shot. As clinicians, we don't have a chance to save their lives.
He's also part of the panel of people who came down to talk about the real demographics of firearm fatalities.
Most gun deaths involve old white guys, not young men of color. Most gun deaths are suicides, not homicides.
That holds true for New Mexico, too. Wintemute says risk factors are things like a history of violence, alcohol abuse, or depression. That's why the consortium is suggesting that if people have two DWIs within 5 years, they should be prohibited from having guns for 5 years. The same would go for people convicted of misdemeanor crimes involving drugs. And for those who commit violent misdemeanors, that would be a 10-year gun prohibition. But the policy change at the top of Wintemute's wish list...
If I had to pick one, which is always not a smart idea, it would be to require a background check for every purchase of a firearm.
As things stand, if people don't purchase guns through a licensed retailer, there's no requirement for a background check in most cases.
The gun is untraceable. There's no record. There's no paperwork.
Wintemute says without universal background checks, even people who are already prohibited from buying guns can still get their hands on them, never mind the additional restrictions the group is proposing. I'm Marisa DeMarco, reporting from Albuquerque.
And now an update on last week's stories about gun legislation in Texas. The state Senate has overwhelmingly passed a bill that would allow concealed handgun license holders to openly display their guns in holsters. Senators also passed another gun rights bill that has drawn criticism from numerous college campuses. It would allow college students to pack guns along with iPads in their backpacks. Texas Public Radio's Ryan Poppy reports.
Currently, college students and faculty that have a license to carry their concealed handguns in public are not allowed to carry them on many state college campuses. A bill by Granbury Republican Senator Brian Birdwell would allow these licensed gun owners to carry their handgun and textbooks in the same backpack while on a state college campus.
Senate Bill 11 will not impact the places that a CHL holder may not otherwise carry now, even if such a location is on the grounds of an institution of higher education. Examples such as such locations would be collegiate sporting events, hospitals, K-12 education facilities, etc., just to name a few.
An amendment by Republican Senator Joan Huffman was added to the bill. It would make openly holstering your handgun while walking on a college campus a crime. Here's Huffman addressing some of Austin Democrat Kirk Watson's concerns about the bill.
So my new amendment, there will be an enforcement mechanism.
So you agree that the way it's currently worded, there would not be an enforcement provision, but you're looking to figure out a way by amendment to create an enforcement provision.
Absolutely.
State colleges would be exempt from assuming liability during a shooting involving a gunman with a concealed carry license on campus. Ryan Poppy, Texas Public Radio News.
Coming up on Fronteras, a look into the classroom of the best bilingual teacher in America.
You are learning two languages, you're learning two cultures, and your brain is developing, you know, at a faster rate than other programs.
And a talk with the director of the new documentary, Western. It explores living with drug cartels in Piedras Negras along the Texas-Mexico border. Those stories next on Fronteras. This is Fronteras. I'm Joey Palacios. Teaching one language to children can be challenging, so imagine teaching two languages to students with various levels of comprehension. One Dallas educator won a top honor this month for doing just that. Irma de la Guardia is the National Bilingual Teacher of the Year. She presides over a third grade class at Withers Elementary School and received the award in Las Vegas from the National Association for Bilingual Education. KERA's Diana Douglas visited De La Guardia's colorful classroom to see her award-winning skills in action.
It's social studies time. What are we studying today? Asks Irma De La Guardia.
Libre empresa,
the free market. De La Guardia asks a child to explain a free market economy to the class in Spanish. The boy doesn't speak Spanish at home, so this is a stretch. He's doing pretty well, but when she asks him to explain what producers do in a free market economy, his Spanish runs out.
¿Qué hacen los productores?
They sell the products.
Ellos venden los productos.
Half of these children are native English speakers and half Spanish speakers. They were matched up in kindergarten to learn elementary school subjects in both.
You are learning two languages, you're learning two cultures, and your brain is developing, you know, at a faster rate than other programs.
A dual language program at Withers started 8 years ago. Now there is a wait list and lottery to get in. This focus on teaching children Spanish is a change for immigrant parents. Traditionally, they've tried to get their kids to learn English as quickly as possible.
Of course, they want their children to learn English, but one of the downsides of going to school was that they were, you know, little by little losing their native language. And, you know, culture comes with language, so they were losing a little bit of their culture as well.
Connie Wallace, principal at Withers, says De La Guardia is dedicated not just to her students, but to parents, fellow teachers, and to the success of the dual language program.
While I know that there are great teachers in the world, Irma stands out.
And while dual language programs are picking up speed in elementary schools across the country, De La Guardia is a veteran. She got a bilingual education herself in Mexico City as a child and has spoken both languages her whole life.
¿Qué haces en un mercado de libre empresa?
The free market has a key word, she tells her students, and she asks everyone to write that word on a portable whiteboard.
En tres, en dos, en uno.
That key word is choice. Now it's time to practice being young capitalists. The students will choose what to buy and sell in their own little stores. There are dolls and ponies and iPhones. The kids run to their stores in the corners of the room. They may not realize that they're preparing for a global job market that favors those who can speak more than one language. I'm Diana Douglas.
A new documentary about the twin border towns of Eagle Pass, Texas, and Piedras Negras, Mexico, has won the Lewis Black Lone Star Award at South by Southwest. The award honors the best Texas-themed film shown at the festival. Texas Public Radio's Nathan Cohn sat down with the director of the film, Western. We begin his review with a scene from the documentary.
The Brussels ceremony reinforces the way we live every day of the week. It's just an opportunity for us to let the world know what our reality on our border is. And our reality is we've been friends for generations and we want to continue.
Es que nuestra abrazo es una ceremonia para reforzar las relaciones que disfrutamos entre todo el año y hemos disfrutado por tantas generaciones y es un símbolo de lo que cómo vamos a seguir. Muchísimas gracias.
That's the late Chad Foster, former mayor of Eagle Pass, who emerges as a central character in the film Western, directed by Bill and Turner Ross. In the clip you heard, Foster was speaking at a ceremony honoring the partnership between the cities of Eagle Pass and Piedras Negras across the border in Mexico. When the Ross brothers came to Eagle Pass, they found a community united. Turner Ross.
You know, I mean, nothing's ever all sunshine, but seemed to be in this really interesting relationship that was buoyant at the time. But there were murmurs of this thing coming, and it was starting to happen.
That thing was drug violence and a fence along the border that few in the city seemed to want. Turner Ross says they didn't go down there to cover the conflict, but it happened.
And that was interesting backdrop. You know, we went for another reason, but the time happened to be just inherently dramatic. You know, a real shift, a flashpoint, you know, for that region.
I asked Bill Ross if they were ever concerned filming in the open in Piedras Negras.
It never got too dicey, but it you could feel it, and you knew sometimes you were in rooms where there were some unsavory folks. But scariest thing was that Turner was supposed to be on the plane with the Piedras mayor when that went down, but we were called away to shoot something else. That was a real eye-opener.
That plane crash Bill Ross referred to was a 2010 accident that killed Jose Manuel Maldonado, the mayor of Piedras Negras. No violence is ever seen on screen in Western. Instead, it's heard on radios or as shared stories among cattlemen whose binational business is impacted when the State Department orders the border closed. Despite the looming storm, Turner Ross says their goal was never to make a film about conflict.
We weren't going down there to stare down the barrel, and we weren't going down there to get killed. We were going down there to continue this adventure and this dialogue that we have with each other, this body of work that we're creating. This one happens to be in a very compelling place that is often headline fodder. And it certainly allowed us into arena and a conversation that we don't usually get to have, and hopefully made for a good film.
Turner says making the movie was a deep experience that will be with him for a long time to come. For Fronteras, I'm Nathan Cohn.
And that's it for Fronteras this week and our stories from the Southwest. You can find the show at tpr.org under the Programs tab. Shelley Koffler and Alexis Yancey produced this broadcast. Chidanga Cakewalk composed this theme music. I'm Joy Palacios in San Antonio, Texas.